I'm Laurie Holtz-Anderson. I'm very, very happy to be back in Sweden. Thank you so much for inviting me. I was the lucky woman who won the 2023 Astrid Lindgren Memorial Award. I'm their laureate. And it has changed my life.
Hi, Laurie.
Hi.
Welcome to Bokskåpspodden. That's the name of this podcast, by the way. Yeah. Bokskåpspodden. I'm sure you, because since you understand a lot of Danish, mm-hmm. Do you speak Danish?
Det gør jeg.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Altså, det er lidt mærkeligt, måske, fordi det er ikke ret mange mennesker, som kan snakke dansk, men det kan jeg.
Ja.
Men jeg kan ikke svensk, desværre.
No.
Nej.
But do you understand like parts of it? Like,
yeah.
Just walking, yeah, when you're in Sweden.
Yeah. And I would really like to learn Swedish much, much better. I think it's a beautiful language. And Danish maybe not so beautiful. But it's
difficult.
It's a little difficult.
Yes. Yeah.
But I was lucky because I learned it when I was very young.
Yeah.
So it's easy to learn things when you're young. But yeah, I think I would like to learn Swedish.
But even so, I'm so impressed because you moved, you stayed 1 year in Denmark.
Correct.
When you were 16, you
yes.
told me.
Yes.
So 1 year.
Yes, but this was before the internet. This is long time ago. Nobody and I lived out in the countryside. I lived on a pig farm and nobody spoke English.
Right.
You know, it was, and my host mother, who could, she could speak English, but she told me the first day I got to their house in a very loving way, and she said this to me in English to make sure I'd understand. She said, if you have an emergency, I will speak to you in English. If you don't have an emergency, this is the last time I will speak English to you. She's from Norway. They don't fool around.
No.
And it was perfect because I, you know, and it was such a, you have to understand, it, you know, go stemning, the atmosphere was so positive and kind and supportive and loving. You can't help but learn everything in those situations. It was great. Also, I don't do math. There are no numbers in my brain,
right.
So there's a little bit of leftover room for Danish language.
For language. Ah, oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's much better.
I think so.
Numbers.
Numbers, who needs those?
But still, I'm super impressed by your language skills. So, like you said, for me and for, I think, most of us in Sweden, you're most famous for being the 2023 Astrid Lindgren Memorial Award laureate.
Mm-hmm.
As of yet, only 3 books have been translated
into
Swedish.
Yes.
So that's Speak
mm-hmm.
and The Impossible
Knife of Memory.
It's such a nice title.
Do you like it?
Yeah, but it's impossible for me to memorize it somehow.
Yeah, that means it's not a very practical title.
But it's beautiful, I think.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then Winter Girls.
Yes.
And Winter Girls just came out like 2 weeks ago in Swedish, so it's
brand new.
Yeah,
yeah.
I just finished reading it the other night, last night.
Mm-hmm.
So I really wanted to thank you for that novel, for writing it. What's it like for you revisiting it now? Like, you wrote it in, it came out in 2009,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I wrote that book because a dear friend of mine who's a pediatrician, a doctor for children and teenagers, she had a lot of patients come to her holding Speak and using the book Speak as an opportunity to talk to their doctor, to talk to her, and tell them about their own sexual abuse or rape or something terrible that had happened to them. The book opened the door to the conversation. And so this friend said, you need to write a book like that about eating disorders, because she had many, many patients struggling with eating disorders. And she as the professional, the families of the patients, and of course, most importantly, the patients themselves, were really struggling to find a way to communicate, especially about what was going on inside the person.
Mm.
You know, when we look at the kind of behaviors of teenagers that make people upset, like turning to drugs or alcohol use or violence or eating, developing an eating disorder, sometimes people focus so much on that symptom that they forget to go underneath. Right. They forget to give the person who's affected by this respect and patience and time. So that you can find out what's driving this, what hurts, what's broken inside. Because I really think that, you know, just trying to, quote, fix that problem that's on the top, that doesn't help the child or the teenager if the pain that's inside them is not taken care of.
Right. This is about Leah and Cassie. Mm-hmm. And you write it in a first person account. So Leah is so like all of you, your like Haley and Melinda. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're out there. They're friends. They're alive.
Yeah,
somewhere out in the world. but how did you approach the subject? Did you interview people or did you talk to patients?
First and foremost, I had my own. I don't think I ever had an eating disorder, but I had some really unhealthy behaviors. My mother was of a generation in America where, I mean, my mother was bone skinny, and she was very, very proud of that. And I'm a big girl, you know, and I'm an athlete, and I didn't fit into my mother's model. And so I learned a lot of bad behaviors, and you know, I used to just completely value myself by how much I weighed, and so some of what, at a much smaller scale, I think, than people who are really struggling the way that Leah and Cassie are in the book. So that was a good entree. I could understand some of what was going on inside. The first people I interviewed were doctors and psychiatrists and nurses, because I had to understand professionally and ethically how to proceed and how to learn and tried to learn about the neurology, about the current belief that there's a certain amount of, they believe, the doctors I spoke to at least, believe that there's, you know how you can kind of be born with a genetic tendency of maybe developing OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, or other things. But somebody who's born with that kind of wiring in their brain doesn't mean that they're going to become somebody with an eating disorder. But if a person like that is put in the circumstances, in the environment, that can become awoken, and then that becomes a really, really difficult challenge. What really, when I was interviewing the doctors, and I was still at that point not convinced that I was the right person for this story, and I find out that in the United States, eating disorder, anorexia in particular, anorexia has the highest fatality rate of any mental illness.
Wow.
And I was like, and then I had to really work through with my editor, you know, when you're writing a book about behavior that is really, really dangerous, how do you describe that behavior in a way that is ethical? So, for example, the doctors told me that, then they reemphasized the need for a book like this and many books like this. And they said if somebody with an active eating disorder walks into, you know, a store that has a model on it and a picture, and that model is beautiful and, of course, digitally altered, that's a very triggering photograph. They said if you have an eating disorder, life is triggering you. Everywhere you turn, you're getting these messages. And they said some people will be triggered by the book. And one of the ways that we tried to I tried to design the book was to not glamorize it at all, not to discuss what she looked like, but just to discuss what she was feeling, what the inside was with her. There were a few times in the book where I had to kind of have her use like a tip, like when she was putting coins in her pockets when she was being weighed on the scale.
Right. Yeah.
But I only took the top three websites that came up when I did a Google search. So they're very common kinds of very easy to find information. So I wasn't training anybody how to do this.
Right.
I did not interview anyone who was actively in the middle of an eating disorder, nor did I interview anybody under age 18. Mm. But I interviewed women who were, well, like at least 10 years into their recovery, and had them look over the book for me. And I had some physicians read the book too before we published it.
How long did it take to?
Years.
Yeah.
Yeah, it always takes years. Yeah. But that's okay, because especially when we're talking about children, we're talking, you know, teenagers, I know they don't like to hear this, but they're, you know, your brains don't stop growing until you're 25.
Yeah.
And so when we're talking about people who are vulnerable, it's very important to do as much as we can to support and not harm them.
Mm. Oh, it's beautiful and heartbreaking, yeah. But also somehow healing a bit, mm. I think. You're such a creative writer in a way, because you use different techniques. In Liesdor, we really get inside her brain, and we get a deeper understanding of her by having those words in or yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Like so it's called in English a strikeout.
Strikeout.
So she has a thought,
yeah.
but like in, I used a strikeout as a line that's drawn through a word. You can do it digitally. You can do it when you're writing. So you see the thought she's having, but then you also see her at the same time refusing the word, refusing to acknowledge it and drawing a line through it.
And it's so powerful. It's such a... Because it says a lot. Like she, I think, at least in the beginning, she doesn't call her mom a mom, but she's a doctor.
Doctor.
And that's, it's very revealing without, you know, writing on.
Right.
Writing it out. You don't have
Better to show than to tell.
Yeah. Yeah. How many years now have you been a writer? 25 years, something like that?
Well, Speak was published 25 years ago.
Yeah.
And I had been, so that was in 1999, and I was a journalist. In 1992, actually September 6th, 1992, that was the day my youngest daughter went to first grade, so she was out of the house for the whole day. And I didn't go to the pancake house with my girlfriends, which is what we used to do the first day of school. And instead, I sat down in my journal. I wrote September 6th, 1992. I'm going to be serious about trying to write books for children or teens. And I gave myself 5 years to get published.
Wow.
And it took me 4 to get... And the book I published was not very good. It was a little picture book that went out of print right away, thank goodness. And
Dito Runs.
Dito Runs. Wow, nobody knows that. That's amazing. And you've done your work. And so, but that got me on the right path.
Right. Because I read, you said... an interview somewhere, that you as a child never sort of envisioned yourself becoming a writer?
Not
although writing was something that you were interested in, and reading was an important thing for you, but...
Absolutely, but I never, you know, I was a kid from a working class family.
Yeah.
And so we have to have jobs that make money, you know, and I thought if anything I'd be a forester like my grandfather, and I liked that, and I had no model.
No.
Every book I read that I liked was by somebody who was already dead.
Right.
And, you know, I was a child in the 60s and 70s, so there was no way of learning really about authors. So it never occurred to me. When I was in high school, I wrote some of the most dreadful poetry ever put to paper. It was so depressing, but it felt so good, and it was so important that I wrote it down.
Mm.
So even if I had never been published, I would still be writing just to kind of, it's another way of feeding my soul. I like it. It makes me happy.
Did you write journals and diaries?
Yeah, absolutely.
But so what changed? What made you write in your journal on September 6th, was it?
I was working at a bookstore.
Oh.
I was working at a bookstore, and I was, you know, I was a mom. I was reading books to my children all the time. And I had been trying to write, and I never took any creative writing courses.
No.
That was not practical at all. Although a linguistics degree isn't very practical either. But I just kept on, when I was working at the bookstore, I'm sure people who work at bookstores will understand this if they want to write. And I was taking out books for children that were written by American celebrities, or even not American celebrities, like Princess Fergie wrote a children's picture book. And I was so irritated and annoyed because I was like, wow, she can write a book. I bet you I can. Mm. You know, I was like putting the books on the shelf and feeling very grumpy. And I just, you know, I know how important books were to me as a child and how they were important to my own children. Mm-hmm. And I just couldn't imagine anything that would be more joyful than writing a book that a child would like.
Mm. But, and also picture books, because in the beginning mm-hmm. of your career, you did picture books.
Yeah, yeah. No, I did no illustrations.
Right, no.
Because I can't draw. But my kids were reading picture books.
Yeah.
And I had that body of knowledge. And then as my kids started, their reading became more complicated as they got older. Then I switched to start trying to write middle grade novels and then YA. And so,
yeah.
And now I have grandkids, so I'm back to writing picture books
really?
Again. Oh, yeah.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is a shout out to all the Swedish publishing houses.
Yeah.
We want them translated, Lori.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll write some new ones and I'll make sure they're good.
Yeah. Good, good, good.
Okay.
But so then, because I'm thinking that it goes pretty quick for you those years. So 96 is the first
Indito Runs. Indito Runs but you have to remember, well, that's true. 96 was, that's when it was published. I think I sold that book in 94, so it took me 2 years to find to make a good, but there's only like 80 words in the book. You can write picture books very quickly. Especially the bad ones, you can write super quickly. And so it takes 2 years generally from the time you turn a book in until it comes out, at least in the US.
Uh-huh.
And at the same time, I was also experimenting with longer forms, even though my focus was on picture books, but I wrote a lot of very bad middle grade novels. But, you know, my husband's a carpenter and he talks a lot about the projects he made when he was a young boy.
Mm-hmm.
And the way he describes them, it's like he kind of had his own apprenticeship. Do you know that word, an apprenticeship?
Yeah.
What do you call that på svenska?
Praktik.
Praktik, yeah. Praktik. And where you have an experienced person working with you, but you have to learn by making your own mistakes, right? So all those early middle grade novels I was writing, I was learning by making a lot of mistakes. But, you know, the only way to learn how to write a book is to try to write a book.
Yes.
And then it's not a great one, probably, if you're like me. But then you try again, and eventually you can have a better understanding of the format, the form, of the length, and how to put in the character art and the plot developments. And then finally I wrote something worthwhile.
Because Speak comes out only a few years after.
Yeah.
And that's your big breakthrough novel.
Absolutely.
I'm assuming, but I mean, there must be like a before and an after Speak.
Absolutely. It changed. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And for all the writers listening to this, Speak was rejected.
What?
Yes, I kept the rejection letter. And it was a good rejection letter because the editor said, she had some nice things to say about it, but she acknowledged that she just wasn't the right editor for this book. Because sometimes you write a book and it's a great book, but it's not going to the right person.
Mm.
And it's so tricky to try to figure out, right? Mm. So I just figured, oh, well. And then the second publishing house I sent it to, the editor liked it, but the ending then was different. And so we had a telephone conversation and she said, you know, your ending is terrible. And up until that moment, I thought it was great. But I said, no, yeah, yeah, you're right. It's terrible. I was going to change that. And so she gave me, she didn't give me a contract, but she gave me the opportunity to try again.
Right, yeah.
And then she gave me a contract. And she was right. Yeah, that ending was terrible.
But how does it work? Because, I mean, did you get an editor and you could, or did you get to do the changing yourself?
I had to do I had to do the changing myself. I didn't have an agent either.
Okay.
I wound up hiring a lawyer to do the contract. And you know, we did one more kind of after we signed the contract and I'd sent in that draft that was more acceptable, then she goes through it and writes me a letter and basically says, this is what works, this is what doesn't work. And editors never tell you how to fix things. That's why your name is on the cover,
right?
You've got to figure out how to fix. And if I didn't agree with her, I didn't have to, but I might have to cancel the contract.
Mm.
But we had a very good working relationship. It worked out well. And then you know, and she didn't want me to get excited. She said, look, don't get your hopes up. It's not going to sell many copies. Teenagers don't read. And she was wrong.
Yes, she was.
She's not an editor anymore.
But tell us about how this speak, I mean, where does it start for you? What's the entry point to this story?
Well, the entry point to the story was I was raped when I was 13. We had just moved, and my father was an alcoholic, and he was in a very bad way in those days. He lost his job, we lost our house, and so my family was kind of falling apart. And I was with a boy that I had met. He was a couple years older than me. I was 13, he was 16. And we went to a kind of an isolated area of a park, completely sober, middle of the day. And I'd liked kissing him, but I didn't want to do anything more, and he did. And so he was much bigger than me, so he raped me. Didn't take long. And then he walked away, and it just broke me. It just... And I couldn't, I was so ashamed. I thought it was my fault. And my parents were already a really big mess. And my dad is American, right? So he had a gun. And I knew if I told them, I was so afraid that daddy would hunt him down and shoot him. And then that would, my father would be in jail and it would be my fault. So I just did what a lot of survivors of sexual violence do, is that we just take the hottest, longest shower you can and don't tell anybody. And, you know, and then I had years of depression following that, you know, and I took drugs that I shouldn't have taken that really kind of made my life harder. And it wasn't until a couple of years after that when I began to still kind of drag myself out of that pit of depression, what really helped me was joining sports teams, and because exercise was quite good for depression.
Right.
And that's really why I wanted to become an exchange student, was to get away.
Ah, that was part of that.
That was part of that. Yeah. And it was, I think the most loving thing my parents ever did for me was to let me go. I was 16, and they didn't see me for 13 months. We talked on the telephone twice. We wrote letters once a month.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I had a 16-year-old daughter that I recognized the sacrifice they made. And they really loved me a lot. I mean, they knew, but they didn't know. You know, they could tell, but they were also struggling so hard with their marriage and the money and the work and everything. So, but by the time I was married, I married young, had my kids young, and I got married too young, and I didn't have any kind of good relationship skills at all, and I was really depressed. And when my oldest daughter got to the age I was when I was raped, that's when I realized that I was not being a good mother. I was so broken and so messed up in my own head that I finally, and I, you know, I'd grown a little bit, I'd matured. That's when I went and got therapy. And that's the first time I told somebody was to my therapist, and cried a river. And that's where the book came from. First of all, I never thought the book would be published. And then I never thought it would sell many copies. And then I never thought that they would ask me to speak at high schools all over America and the world. And then I never thought that there would be an amazing young man in Tucson, Arizona, who in one of my early presentations, there's always a Q&A at the end. In my early presentations, I never said my truth. I just talked about the writing process and kind of boring things. And this brave young man said, Miss, did that happen to you? In the Q&A, and there's like 1,000 kids in this auditorium. And I felt like all of their eyes were on me, because they were. And I realized that if I was going to be a responsible adult, and I'd written a book that was called Speak, that I owed my audience the truth. So that's when I told for the first time publicly the story. And all their heads, so many heads nodded in that audience. And that was the first time that somebody came up to me in tears after my presentation. And since that day in Tucson, Arizona, I have never given a public presentation where I haven't had somebody come up to me afterwards, usually in tears, but sometimes they'll just slip me a little note, or they'll DM me later that night. We have so, it is criminal. It is so violent, the silencing of victims. Yeah. You suffer once because of the attack or the molestation or the whatever of the horrible varieties are. And then because I think you do a little bit better job in the Nordic countries, but I've heard from victims as well here. I think that the silencing that our culture, our Western culture, imposes on victims is another punch. It's another form of violence.
Yeah.
But that's the bad news. Good news is I know we can make a difference by creating a variety of literature in a variety of forms that will speak to different people at different levels because we use this as what we human beings do. We've always done this since we learned how to make fires. Mm. We use story to help each other. Mm.
But so when that person, that man asked you that question, you're totally unprepared to answer, but you do.
Yeah.
And you tell the story. And what happens to you? I mean, it must be...
Well, I was a little nervous that they were going to kick me out of school. It didn't happen there, but it did happen in other places where I got kicked out after saying that. So I had to put it in my contract shortly after that I was going to talk about these things, and the principal had to sign off on it because I wasn't going to waste their time and mine getting kicked out. But it was life changing. It was also very affirming. When I realized that if I could talk about this in a responsible way, you know, like not painting anybody who's male as the bad guy, right? Acknowledging that victims can be male or female or trans or anywhere on the spectrum of identities and gender, and also. At first, I was focusing only on victims, but then I learned, because I had other boys in other schools asked me really important questions, because so many boys, at least in the U.S., so many states, we don't have good, responsible sexuality curriculum in school. So they learn about sex about age 11 by watching violent pornography on their phones, and they think that's what it's supposed to look like. But when I come in and I would talk to them about sort of the emotional aftermath of somebody, you know, and they're all confused because they said, Miss, sex doesn't take that long. Why was she still upset after a year? And so that's a great question. I have such respect for that question and such respect for the young men who had the courage to ask it.
Yeah.
And so I that really kind of, you know, convinced me yet again of the need to be in a responsible adult way, an age-appropriate way, honest with children about our bodies and the law and the morality, the need for consent, the need for sober consent. That really surprises them.
What an eye-opener also for you. It's sort of like a direct channel into these young men and women's thoughts and ideas that probably had never been, you know, if you hadn't said what you said,
exactly.
If you hadn't told your story.
Exactly.
So it was, I'm thinking here that it must have been like almost a sense of taking control of your story and owning it.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about it like that. I do know that I was very nervous for a while as I processed it. I talked to some of my friends who were teachers and, you know, made the adjustments in my contract so everybody knew that if you invited me, they were going to hear the truth about a lot of things. But I think the most meaningful thing is to hear from the kids after I present, not all of them victims, but all of them learning. And one of my favorite fan letters came from a girl in Idaho years ago. And she wrote me like the first two pages of her letter, old-fashioned letter, and threw the mailbox. And she made very, very clear to me that she had a great life. And she was a little pissed at me because she felt I was disrespectful to teenagers in my book, which she was completely right. I think they're useless. I don't think they're cheerleaders are not useless. The sport of just having girls in short skirts cheering on male teams is a little patriarchal for my taste.
I agree.
But then she wrote, "Your book made me see that not everybody has a life like mine. And there's this weird girl in our school who always sits alone in the cafeteria. And after I read your book, I decided I would eat lunch with her one day. And I did. And we talked to each other and we're nothing alike. She said, she was so honest, this kid. I hope she's having a good life. And then she said, but I decided that as long as I was in that school and she was in that school, she was never going to eat lunch alone again. And that's why we need to provide a variety of books that reflect reality for all of our kids.
Mm. I was thinking about this also, Laurie, when reading up on you, and it's such an interesting, your whole authorship is so, it's so many layers. You write, speak, you've written over 30 books, you've done so many books. I mean, and it's about what it's about. It's about trauma and dealing with trauma. And it was a way for you to heal.
Absolutely.
Somehow.
Absolutely.
But then, and it's about how you know, the silencing of victims.
I can add one layer to that, too. I want you and everybody listening to this to close their eyes for a moment and think about the adults that they know who are not doing well. The adults who have emotional issues, who are maybe have developed coping mechanisms that have become dangerous, like drinking or drugs or overwork or things like that. Not always, but overwhelmingly the majority of the time, the root of that pain that is still hurting them, still traumatizing them, goes back to their childhood or their adolescence.
Mm.
And we're a little bit better, I think, in Western cultures at recognizing when younger children have been affected by something. The signs are a little bit more dramatic. And so we can get them to the kind of support that they need. But with teenagers, you know, teenagers are in their own world, in their own way. And I think sometimes we don't want to interfere in their lives too much. We want to give them the space. But when we don't make them feel safe enough to tell some responsible adult about what's going on, what happened, you know, and often I think it's because the kid feels that they made a mistake and it's their fault. You know, I shouldn't have gone to that party. I shouldn't have had that drink, whatever. And then they just pile that responsibility on top of themselves too. And anybody who's above the age of 20 knows somebody like this. And those mistakes and the pain that are caused by whatever happened that night or that day, that can echo for decades, altering the course of that person's life, which is another reason why, you know, we want to make sure that we all understand. I think sometimes the real people who need to read books like mine or other authors out there, YA books, realistic fiction, the adults need to read them.
Mm. Yes.
So they can understand how hard things are for our teens.
Mm. Absolutely. I was also thinking of like the layer of you being silenced. Your books are banned and censored, and I mean that's another level of or another layer of like re-traumatizing somehow. You write about this, you know.
That's what it feels like. Yeah. That's what it feels like. And for those people who don't know, starting in 2021, there was a massive nationwide organized effort by right-wing fascists in the United States to remove books from public schools that have anything to do with sex. They focused on books that contain, including a book about rape they think is a book about sex, and all books, all and any books about LGBTQ people, and any LGBTQ authors, any authors who are not white, authors who are not evangelical Christian, authors who are not cisgendered and heterosexual. Because I write books about sexual violence, I've been labeled a pornographer and a pedophile. My books, half of the schools in Florida, they've destroyed my books. I've had constant my income is been cut in half. But you know, my kids are grown, so I'm going to be okay. Don't worry about me. The most concerning thing is, in the last 10 years in the U.S. in children's literature, we've been working really hard to open up our field and to embrace and welcome and support all kinds of authors that have been shut out from children's publishing before, particularly authors who are Black or brown and authors who aren't straight or cisgendered. You know, children's publishing is a pretty much upper-class, white, rich person's field for a long time. But it was working. And some of these incredible authors that we've had, I know Angie Thomas has been translated into Swedish, and she's incredible. David Levithan, I met his translator the other day. We have so many great voices, diverse voices. And they are now, you know, in the beginning of their career. So when their books get banned in half of Florida, they have to go, you know, their kids are young. They have to go back to their job as an accountant or as a nurse or something. And we're going to lose the stories that they wanted to tell. Not to mention, this book banning is against the Constitution. I'm part of a lawsuit. Me, three other authors, and Penguin Random House and a few other organizations are suing the state of Iowa for their law. Right. In Iowa, children who are 16 or 17 are allowed to have sex, as long as it's somebody that's close in age to them, but they're not allowed to read about it in the library. So, and the lawsuit's going to be going, Penn America is supporting us.
Yeah.
I know Penn Svenska had a wonderful banned book week here in Sverige last year, so that was cool. So I found that I was very, very depressed because of all this banning. It was like I felt like for the last couple of years, like my life's work was meaningless. And then the nice people at Astrid Lindgren gave me the incredible award. And then that kind of helped me find my voice again. And so I've been able to fight back.
Yeah.
And that energizes you.
But has it also done anything practically in the U.S. for you? Has it made any difference in the banning or in the...
No. Oh, you mean the Alma piece?
Yeah.
Sadly, although I'm trying to change this, it's not really well known in the United States yet.
No.
It will be. When I get done, it will be. But we are hopeless in America sometimes. We need some help.
But it means that... And I'm sorry if I'm not... Maybe I should have done more research on this, but it's so confusing for me, the U.S. in general.
Yeah,
sorry,
right?
But also because different states can make different rules. So in one state, is speak, for example, is speak banned in all the states in the U.S.?
Only not in Vermont. Vermont is the only state that hasn't had any book banning. And it's important, and I think I had talked to some educators on this trip that have helped me understand an important difference in the government of education. And in Sweden, your school districts are run by professionals who are very well educated and who make these decisions. In America, our school districts, we have teachers, we have administrators, but the top leadership level of a school district, which could be a town or a huge, giant county, depending on the state, those are people who are elected. They're just community members who are voted, and they're called school board members.
Mm.
There's the town next to mine, last 2 years ago, there were school people who were running for the school board as Republicans who weren't honest about what they policy changes they wanted to make. So they got voted in. It's kind of a conservative area. And as soon as they got in, they took out the pride flags. They made it against school rules for teachers to admit they're gay. They made it against school rules for anything to do with homosexuality or transsexual people to be discussed in classes. I mean, they're being sued by the ACLU. And thankfully, we've had another election. All of those people were voted out of office. But because you can have, you know, just ordinary citizens with an agenda, and they can lie about what they want to do on the school board, that's why you're seeing this kind of banning. And it's going to take another decade, I think. And I think it's going to take a lot of lawsuits. So lawyers are all going to make a lot of money on this.
Right.
And this is probably part of an overdue reckoning in the United States, where we have to admit the failings of our government, the failings of our structure of government.
Mm.
Obviously, we've got a very active group of fascists in the U.S. who don't like the site, don't like the idea that we are a nation of all colors, of all peoples. We're the place that people come to when they want to try something new or do something better. We're either descended in the U.S. from immigrants like my family, or from people who were kidnapped into slavery, or from Native Americans who are all, you know, victimized by genocide. So we are a country built of blood and hope.
Mm.
And we have to rebalance the scales, I think.
Mm. And what would happen to a librarian if, I mean, what would happen?
Well, there have been some attempts in some states to have school librarians arrested by the police.
Mm.
Because what they do is and honestly, I try very hard not to be judgmental, but it's really, really hard. I just want to scream at these people.
Mm.
There were a few attempts where they would go to the sheriff's office, the local police, and say, this librarian is passing out pornography to children, and that's against the law, and you have to go and arrest it. And in every case, the police, you know, you make a complaint like that, so the police would go to the school and interview the principal and interview the librarian. And no librarians have been arrested. But one of the reasons we decided to file that lawsuit in Iowa is that they passed this law that we're fighting last year, in May of last year. And part of the law said that if teachers don't remove these kinds of books, meaning books with gay characters or books that, like mine, that contain some type of sexuality in them,
mm.
not only could the teachers lose their jobs, the teachers could lose their license to teach in the state of Iowa, destroying their livelihood. Yeah, there are places where there are hotlines that you can call in to complain.
Yeah.
And there are so many communities where the books are being removed. You could have a community that has 500,000 residents in a big county in Florida, say, 500,000 people living there in that town or that community with many, many towns in it. And you can have a group of 5, 10, 20 people who get one of the lists off the internet that have these book lists, and they send the list in, and the superintendent who runs the school district is so nervous, oh no, they're all going to come after me now, that they pull the books.
Mm.
And at the same time, you have what's called soft censorship, where libraries in communities that aren't being targeted yet, but the superintendent or the principal will talk to the librarian and say, you know what, let's just be safe. Take the books out for the time being.
Mm.
And those don't get reported in the news.
No.
You know, we don't have a database of those cases.
Right.
So it is gross, it's ugly, and it's really harmful for our kids. In areas where we're seeing these book bannings, we're seeing an increase in bullying, particularly of gay kids or kids who are questioning their, you know, or identifying as queer. Much more bullying of kids who are black or brown, and a lot more sexual abuse, not surprisingly.
It's just, don't come
to America right now. I'm telling you guys, take your tourist money elsewhere, because it's not a safe place.
And the consequences of, I mean, it's too big to even like grasp the consequences of what this means on so many different levels. I mean, it's just, yeah.
Exactly. And when we think about how precious our children are, and those, and we only have their childhood, their adolescence is such a short period of time.
Mm.
So in the U.S., you know, you guys were a lot smarter about lockdowns than we were. So we have kids now who missed 2 years of school because of lockdowns on and off. And then they go to school and the books have been taken away. So you're going to have, you know, about a half generation, assuming we could fix it tomorrow and all the books went back on the shelves. You have kids who have missed four to six years of chances to read widely, to choose books that they wanted. And I really want to emphasize this. No child in America has ever been forced to read a book. You know, if there's always been, parents have always had the ability in every state, in every community, to talk to a teacher, talk to a librarian and say, look, I don't want my kid to read this kind of book for reasons.
Yeah.
And it's the family's, you know, who knows what trauma that kid has seen or been through.
Mm.
And it's the parent's job to choose books for their children
if
they don't feel like that their kids are old enough to choose for themselves. But it's not anybody's job to choose for the children of other people. And in a democracy, we need to have a broad... There's books in the library I don't like either, but I don't have to read them if I don't like them.
Exactly.
So we're supposed to be able to have a broad variety of voices and stories to choose from. And I don't know, man, these people must have had miserable childhoods. They didn't read enough books, that's for sure.
No, exactly. Oh, I'm sorry, Lori. That's awful.
Thank you. Yeah. I appreciate that.
Okay, but back to the writing process.
Let's do that. It's much more fun.
Exactly. I just also wanted to ask you, before we're moving away from speak.
Yeah.
What was it like for you to watch your characters come to life on the movies?
Oh, the movie. That was really, fun.
And were you part of the...
Yeah, I was. I'm actually in the movie.
I think I saw that. I haven't seen the movie, but I saw like a small clip and I thought
I was a lunch lady. I put the mashed potatoes on the plate. I had the opportunity to write the script for the movie, which I turned down.
Okay.
So I was working on another book. I knew nothing about script writing. Maybe I'd do it differently now because I have a little bit of experience, but I'm glad I didn't. It was made on a very low budget, which I think comes, you know, it was made for television in like 2003. And I learned a lot about, it's not the book. A book can never be turned into a movie unless it's going to be 18 hours long. But I appreciate the choices that they made. There's one thing that pisses me off. I have to be honest about this. Yeah. The ending of the movie is different than the ending of the book.
Okay.
And I don't want to give it away for anybody, but I will tell you that the ending of the movie was demanded by the company that put up the money to make the movie.
Right.
And the director fought for my ending in the book because there's a good reason for that ending. And the producers, the people who brought the money to the table, they said, this needs to be a family-friendly movie. And if you don't put the ending that we want, we won't give you the check you need to make the movie. And that's the way things work in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. But it was super cool. They filmed it in a high school in, I think it was Columbus, Ohio. We were just talking about Ohio. Mm-hmm. And I got to be on set for a couple of days with my oldest daughter. Mm-hmm. And it was magical watching them make it. I was really happy.
Cool.
Yeah.
And then a few years later, Speak is also graphically interpreted.
Yeah, graphic novel. Yeah. I did the writing for that. That was for the writers out there, I strongly encourage you, if you want, or especially if you're trying to work on problems with structure and storytelling, take your favorite book and take two chapters from your favorite book and then write out a graphic novel script for those two chapters. And, you know, think about how many panels you would put on a page and what the how to visualize the action and then boil it down to the absolute minimum of dialogue and description.
Right.
Such a great storytelling technique. I learned a lot from that. And the artist of the Speak graphic novel is a Canadian artist named Emily Carroll, and she just hit it out of the park. It's a fantastic, great job.
And this whole idea came from you, right?
Yeah, I kind of had a little bit of a temper tantrum and got my way for a change.
But you also wanted her specifically?
Yes, Emily Carroll? Yeah, they let me choose.
Yeah.
I mean, if I had chosen somebody that they thought was absurd, they would have let me know. But it was really nice to be able to be part of that process.
Mm. Wow, cool.
Yeah.
I haven't seen that. I have to order it. I run a bookstore.
You do run a bookstore. Yeah, you should probably, yeah. I thought, well, maybe one of the nice publishers in Sweden could have it translated.
Yes, they should.
Yeah.
They should.
They should.
It's the 25th.
This is the 25th anniversary of Speak. Yep. And I was just in, where was I just? I was in Umeå. And yeah. I was in, they've got a beautiful library in Umeå. Oh my gosh. And a wonderful bookstore, Pilgatan Bookstore.
I haven't been there, but it's
worth the trip.
Yeah.
So good. But I was so impressed with their huge selection of graphic novels.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly graphic novels are really appreciated in Sverige.
Verkligen. I wanted to talk to you about your writing process.
Mm.
How does it work for you? Is it different? Do you have a way of of doing it. Have you found a way that works for you, or does it differ between, like, how to?
Well, there's a big difference between the way I write YA novels and the way I write historical fiction.
Okay.
My historical fiction starts in the actual events of the time period and the place. For me, it's the United States during and after the American Revolution. Mm. And then I'll narrow it down. The new book I have coming out in the fall is about Boston in March of 1776 to October. So I have to do a ton of research, which I love. I love research so much. Oh, so good. And then I structure sort of the big event, the historical events that I want my characters to interact with. Mm-hmm. And then because I'm always looking for these things that we learn about in American history, but we only learn about it from the power holders' perspective. Mm-hmm. I want to know what was life like for regular people, for working people, for kids, and people held in slavery. And so I start with the plot, basically, and then I have to develop characters, and I have to develop the interior life of the character and figure out how to braid together the lives of the characters with the events of the time and place. My YAs are completely different. My YAs, I start out with something that's really upset me, something that pisses me off about, mm-hmm. in terms of the way teenagers in the U.S. are treated, the kind of problems that they have because of structural failings of institutions or family problems or whatever. Everybody's got problems. And I'll read about it and I'll think about it and I'll journal about it, usually for a couple of years.
Right.
And then I'll do some research here and there. And I was talking to somebody the other day and I said, it's like when the tide goes out, if you go every day when the tide goes out and you pick up interesting things on the beach and you take them back and you leave them probably on your back porch because your mother doesn't want to smell that inside the house. But if you do that every day for a couple of seasons, you wind up with a really interesting collection. And when I'm journaling and I'm researching and I'm just thinking about the story and this thing that's like upsetting me, like eating disorders or the way young men are treated in America and toxic masculinity and things like that. And then I'm assembling all these different notions. And then finally I'll hear a character it sounds kind of weird, but it is weird. The character's voice, they start to talk. Now, sadly, they don't dictate the entire book.
Oh, crap.
I know, annoying. But it's enough like, oh, there you are. Now right. that I really think the smartest part of my brain is the subconscious part. And I have to like do all the beach combing. I have to go find all these little bits of information and emotion and metaphors and things like thematic issue things to think about. And then suddenly the subconscious wakes up the conscious brain and says, okay, it's time to start typing.
Mm. But do you also look within? Do you also go like...
Oh, always, always. I don't think I can write about something unless I'm feeling some kind of emotional connection to it. You will usually, especially when you're reading a book that really resounds in you, that really moves you deeply, I can almost guarantee you, at least based on my friends who are writers and me, that probably you have found something in that book that reflects not maybe a truth about the author's life, but some of their emotional truth. You know, you can't hide from your own emotional truth, right? So it colors everything that we touch. Mm. So it's there. Mm. Maybe people who like write, I don't know. I'm thinking about even people I know who write fantasy. There's still some of them on the page. You know, it might look different. It might be in a different world or whatever. Or if it's a romance or a mystery, the genre doesn't matter. But if it's a book that that finds an audience, or even if it's just one audience, if it touches one person, there is something of the author in that book, I guarantee you.
Mm. Yeah. I just feel sometimes me as a reader or readers in general, I'm not sure, but we're a bit too eager sometimes to think that, you know, to assume that
but that's okay.
The protagonist in the story.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that.
The author.
There's nothing wrong with that. And I think, that's fine.
Yeah.
And you know, even like I'm so lucky I get to come to Sweden and And like, there's a part of me that's the outside me that people see, and there's parts of me that are still private. But I, you know, I used to get emails from kids who they were in a debate with their teacher. I guess this is a pre-pandemic thing. They were in a debate with their teacher about like, what does the author mean in this book? Like trying to interpret the author's original meaning. And I think that's a load of hogwash. I think that it doesn't matter. I mean, I know what I was trying to say in the book, but every reader brings themselves to the page.
Yeah.
And that's the difference between writing for younger children and writing for teenagers. I don't have to fill in all the blanks for the teenagers. They fill it in themselves. And so if a teen or any adult reads my book and comes up with a meaning that's completely different from what I intended, it's fine. It's like if, you know, I think stories are maybe like an old mirror that's a little bit cracked. It's a little bit, you know, when you're reading a story, you're reading what the author was trying to bring. But you fill in the places for yourself. So it's all good. It's all good. So the to teachers out there, there is no one meaning. Please stop making that assignment.
Yeah, exactly.
Give them some
right
room.
Right or wrong.
Yeah. Right.
Because I know I read somewhere in an interview that you said, after what happened to you at the age of 13, you were raped. One thing that was a sanctuary place for you was the act of reading.
Oh gosh,
reading.
Yeah.
The very act of reading, I know exactly what you mean, and I can totally understand. But I was also thinking, if writing is that for you as well, is that a place for?
No, it's not.
No.
No. As occasionally it is, but more often, you know, it's my job.
Yeah.
I prefer to if I want to get lost, I want to read somebody else's work.
Right. That's what I mean also, because I'm thinking then that that's me assuming that writing, for example, The Impossible Knife, that was also a healing process for you. Assuming that,
I think it was. It was definitely a healing. It was helped heal my father's relationship with me. Because there's quite a bit of our relationship in the character's relationship with her father.
Right.
And by that point, my father was in his 80s, and I had moved my parents to live very close to where I lived so we could take care of them. And my dad was very, very physically fit and mentally fit up until the last 2 or 3 months of his life. We were really lucky that way. And so Daddy and I used to have to go pick him up at 4:30 in the morning. So we would go to the gym together. And then we would go to a restaurant and eat really not healthy, delicious breakfast food. And finally, we were able to talk about all the hard things that our family had gone through, and especially about his experience in Germany in World War II and how that affected him. And, you know, I think we had both gotten to the age where I've always loved my parents. I mean, it doesn't feel right to talk about them in the past because they're still with me, you know. But boy, did we have some rough years. Ooh-wee. And so Daddy knew that I was writing that book, and he read it. I wasn't going to, you know, publish it if he felt that it was too close to home. And right. He gave me his blessing. So, I think there's I can speak for myself and some of my friends who shall remain nameless. But yes, writing is very good therapy.
Yeah.
And it's cheaper than going to therapy.
Yes.
Yes.
Yep. Gotcha.
Just get your journals out, my friends.
Exactly.
Makes sense on the page.
Mm. 2019. Shout.
Oh, yeah.
A memoir in poetry.
Yeah.
It's, yeah.
I was pissed.
Yeah.
I was so angry.
Yeah.
I was walking down a street in New York City. I was supposed to be working on a novel. And I was, actually. And shocking to say. But what was happening, you know, the Me Too movement had begun. And let's just all pause here for a moment and acknowledge that the Me Too hashtag was begun by an incredible activist named Tamara Burke, B-U-R-K-E, yes, in the United States, and she's got a great website, MeTooMovement.org. She coined that hashtag in 2006. But in 2017-18, some women in Hollywood began to use it, and that's how it really came to the consciousness in the United States. And whenever you have any kind of progress in social activism, here comes the backlash,
right,
especially when you're talking about the patriarchy. And I was listening to a podcast, and it was about, I think, Brett Kavanaugh's nomination to the Supreme Court and the backlash that the woman who spoke up about him was facing. And I was older than I was when I wrote Speak. And I had, 20-odd years of listening to survivors of sexual violence under my belt. And I was seeing red walking down 11th Avenue. Mm. And then lines of poetry started to drop in my head. The way, strong emotions bring out poetry in us.
Yeah.
And I started writing.
Had you written poetry before that?
I'd written poetry my whole life.
Oh.
My father was a poet.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so I had it. He gave me this wonderful example of, but it, poetry, I wrote a poem in the 10th anniversary edition of Speak that reflected sort of my experience with how many survivors found some comfort in the book.
Mm.
But that was the first time, and I was never going to show my poetry to the world. But I had to explain to my editor that I wasn't writing that novel anymore. And I said the words that no editor ever wants to hear, which is, I'm going to write a memoir in poetry. It's like an editor's worst nightmare. It's like, no. But she was very patient. I might have heard a bottle open on the other end of the line, but she said, that sounds like a great project for you. You could just, she's pounding her head on the desk as she says that.
Absolutely, Lori.
Go with your bad self. So that's what I wrote. And it was fair that. So I was, I was an older woman by that point, and I'd been through some interesting, good life experiences. That was a very powerful bit of writing for me.
Mm.
I think the book's a little uneven, to be honest, because I think I was, they wanted me to put in lots of stories about my life and stuff. Maybe I'll bring out an edition of it one day that just is a shorter book that's kind of laser focused on what I've learned.
Hmm.
But I that was very helpful writing for me.
Now you said to your publisher that now I'm doing this, so the other thing will be on hold for a while. Mm-hmm. Is that how you work normally, or do
different? No, normally it's like, okay, you signed a contract for that book. Where is it? And I'm like, because and this is a reality in the U.S. to make your living as a writer. You spend, even if you're graced with success the way I've been, I was still before the pandemic spending more than half of my time traveling on the road and speaking to students, also speaking to colleges and teachers educators and things like librarians. It's very hard to write that.
Yeah.
But
since you do also a lot of, when you do your historical books, and then it sounds like, and you describe how the processes are so different, it must also be kind of nice to have those.
Well, that's why I like it.
Back and forth. Yeah,
exactly, right? Because I don't think I'm not, everybody has to find the style and the method of writing that suits them best.
Yeah.
I have a pretty short attention span. And so to do the same thing over and over again is like my nightmare.
Mm.
So going back and forth between historical fiction and contemporary YA has served me very well. And I have two different publishers. Actually, I have three. Speak is done at a separate house. And they all are a little bit cranky, because they all want me not to be writing on the other house's project, but they're very understanding.
Yeah. I asked you before starting the interview, because I didn't want to sort of, impose anything on you, if you wanted to read one of the poems in Shout.
I would love to do that.
And you're, of course, free to read. whichever you want.
Yeah. I had to do a reading in Umeå the other night, and they only gave me 8 minutes, and I really needed like 47, so it was super hard. But I'm going to read to you one that you said that you liked. It's a poem from the end of the book, and it's called Reminder. The wings of angels connect to their backbones, just behind their steadfast hearts. Tree trunks connect sun-breathing leaves, chlorophylling with life to their roots muddy dark. The spines of books connect page to page, writer to reader, teacher to student, page to page, past to future, pain to power, page to page, rage to peace. This note about anatomy from me to you is for the remembering that after you speak, after you shout, your open mouth will breathe in the light for which you've hungered, and your backbone will unfurl until you can again dance to the beat of your steadfast heart. Da var den.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Mm. It's an honor. No. You're such an inspiration. I'm not sure how this will land, but I always end the podcast with saying thank you and I'm sorry. Mm. You know, like thanks and sorry.
Yeah. Oh.
So yeah, thanks and sorry, Lori.
Yeah, thanks and sorry, my dear. Det finaste jag äger, det finaste jag har, det finaste jag säger, det finaste jag spar, det vill jag ge till Britta, och Britta det är jag, den finaste jag känner. Det finaste jag äger, det finaste jag har, det finaste jag säger, det finaste jag spar, det vill jag ge till Petter, och Petter det är jag, den finaste jag känner.